Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Canon Shamnagam, who is a partner at Paul Weiss in Washington, D.C. Canon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jody and Todd. It's great to be with you.
We should point out that we are recording this live from the Advanced Appellate Seminar here in Austin at the lovely Four Seasons. And so you may hear a little bit different sound than what we usually have, but the three of us are actually gathered live around a single microphone, huddled in a corner at the Four Seasons. But we decided we couldn't miss this opportunity to visit with Canon live, and we look forward to bringing some more programming like this to you flowing from this seminar.
Well, it's great to be here at the State Bar of Texas meeting. And the one thing you didn't mention, Todd, is that we're doing this at 7 in the morning. So we're all sitting here with our giant mugs of coffee.
That's right. Well, and thank you for accommodating us. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Canon, I think a lot of our listeners probably know who you are already. But if you would just maybe give us a little bit of background, tell us about yourself, kind of how you got to where you are today.
Sure. So I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas. My father was a professor at the University of Kansas, and that's why when I tweet, I tend to tweet about the Jayhawks rather than about the law. And then I went back east, as I think folks would say in these parts, for college and for law school. I was not somebody in college who was sure I wanted to be a lawyer. You know, I grew up in the 1980s, so I guess in some sense I always wanted to be Harry Hamlin's character in L.A. Law. But when I went to college, if you had asked me on the first day of freshman year, I probably would have told you that I was going to be a journalist rather than a lawyer. I was a very serious college journalist. I was the editor of the Harvard Independent, which was the weekly newspaper on campus. I spent 2 summers working for the Kansas City Star, essentially my hometown newspaper. And it was only really toward the end of college that I had the epiphany that being a journalist was going to be a pretty tough career. And that was really even before the advent of the internet and the effects that that had on journalism. And I started to really think about law school. And by the end of my time at Harvard, I was pretty sure I was going to go to law school. I had a bit of a 2-year detour. I went to England and did a graduate degree. But at the end of that time, I came back and came back to Harvard, where I went to law school. But in some sense, I think I was an accidental appellate lawyer as well as lawyer, because when I was in law school, I was pretty sure I wanted to be a trial litigator. Mm-hmm. And I spent my 2L summer at Cravath in New York, which then as now did not have an appellate practice. And it was really only after clerking first for Judge Luttig on the Fourth Circuit and then for Justice Scalia that I started to think about a career in appellate law.
We've had the privilege of having former U.S. Supreme Court clerks now on the show, so we're happy to add you to that number. Do you have a quick Scalia story you can tell us, the one that you can share publicly?
Well, there are just so many stories about Justice Scalia, but when I think back on the year I had with him, I think my abiding memory of him will be him hunched over his computer working on one opinion or another. He had just gotten back from a trip to Japan, and he had this Japanese baseball cap that was about 3 sizes too small for his head. And so he'd be sitting at his desk with this baseball cap hunched on the top of his head, typically smoking a cigarette because that was one of his vices, and working away on a draft opinion. And he took writing so seriously. I think when I think back on that year, you know, it's very tempting to think about Justice Scalia and to think, here's somebody for whom writing just came naturally. And I think if he were still with us, he would be the first to say that that was not the case, that it was really hard work, and he labored over every sentence and every word in much the same way that the rest of us mere mortals do. And so when I think back on the year, that's my vision of the year, is basically Justice Scalia working away on draft opinions. And, you know, it was just such an incredible privilege to have the opportunity to work with him and to learn from him.
Which term did you clerk at the court?
So I clerked at the court in the 1999-2000 term. So that was the same term as a number of luminaries, including Texas luminaries. That was the same term as Justice Brett Busby from the state Supreme Court and his incredibly impressive wife, Erin. They met during the clerkship year, so they were the one couple that kind of emerged from our year. There was also somebody by the name of Ketanji Jackson who clerked during that year, who of course has also gone on to great things. So it was really a wonderful group of people. As I think Erin told you guys when she came on your podcast, it was a very collegial year at the court. Mm-hmm. And so I think we had very deep friendships across chambers, both during the year and thereafter. We actually, Vicki, my wife and I, hosted a reunion of the law clerks from our year, I think for the 20th anniversary of the clerkship. And virtually everyone came, which I think is a testament to mm-hmm. how deep those bonds were.
Were there any sort of standout cases from the 99-2000 term that really stick with you?
You know, it was really a blockbuster term. As I think Erin told you, it will forever be remembered as the term before Bush versus mm-hmm. Gore. But it was actually a really significant term in that, sort of like the recently completed Supreme Court term, we had cases across seemingly every major area of the law. We had the first of the two partial birth abortion cases that year. We had the Dickerson case on whether or not Congress had the power to effectively overrule Miranda. We had a number of cases on criminal procedure because it was in the immediate aftermath of the enactment of AEDPA, the statute that reformed the habeas process. We had a case involving prayer at high school football games, actually mm-hmm. a case coming out
from
of
Texas.
Santa Fe School District mm-hmm. here in Texas. So in some sense, a lot of cases that actually really prefigured the cases last term, because in a lot of these areas of the law, those cases ended up being important precedents for things that the Supreme Court did last year.
Mm-hmm. Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
So where did you head after your Supreme Court clerkship?
So I started my legal career at Kirkland and Ellis, and at the time, the head of the appellate practice there was another Texan, Ken mm-hmm. Starr, who had been Solicitor General of the United States. And I went to Kirkland really without a clear desire to be an appellate lawyer. I knew by the point that I had finished my clerkship that it was something that I wanted to have as a significant part of my practice. But I joined Kirkland in November of 2000, right after Ken came back from having been independent counsel. And Ken had worked with just an incredible parade of lawyers. I'm not mm-hmm. sure that there's any appellate lawyer in America who has so many significant figures in his coaching tree, but he, you know, had worked very closely with Paul Clement when Paul was an associate at Kirkland in his first stint there. He worked with Brett Kavanaugh, and indeed Justice Kavanaugh was one of the people who recruited me to Kirkland and then promptly left the firm on my second day there to go down to Tallahassee to work on what ended up becoming Bush versus Gore. So I really didn't work all that closely with now Justice Kavanaugh when I was at Kirkland. But precisely because Ken had gone away for a while, I think a lot of the people in his core team had kind of gone and done different things. Mm-hmm. And so Ken came back to the firm in the fall of 2000. I joined the firm, and there were immediately tremendous opportunities to work with Ken on significant appellate matters. And so I really look back on those years as really kind of the formative years, both in my deciding to focus on appellate work, but also in really developing as an appellate lawyer.
It seems like with young lawyers, even young lawyers coming out of Supreme Court clerkships, you know, having that kind of sort of formative relationship with someone who's experienced, obviously somebody who had been at the top level, like Judge Starr, really can impact that younger lawyer. And so would you say that that was the case with you, that Judge Starr helped put you on that path?
Absolutely. When I think back on the wonderful mentors I've had at virtually every stage of my career, Ken would be right at the top of that list. And Todd, you're absolutely right. I mean, every year there are 36 or so Supreme Court clerks who are newly minted, any number of clerks for great Court of Appeals judges, for state Supreme Court judges, and the like. And the reality is that particularly in the appellate area, only a very small number of those people are really going to emerge. And I think that the key differentiator is having a wonderful mentor early in your career, getting tremendous opportunities where you get a lot of responsibility. And Ken is certainly somebody, I would say another of my future bosses, Ted Olson, is another, who was and is really adept at promoting the next generation. And boy, the opportunities I got during those 4 years at Kirkland really set me on my way without question. And in particular, you know, I had the opportunity really to be one of the principal brief writers on the briefs in McConnell versus FEC, which was the challenge to the constitutionality of McCain-Feingold at the Supreme Court level. And I think for somebody who was, you know, 3 or 4 years off a clerkship, as I then was, you know, that was really a career-defining opportunity.
Well, that's an incredible lineup of folks that you had the privilege of working under and being mentored by. I mean, some of the names at the very upper echelon of appellate practice. So I'm a little jealous.
Well, I was really lucky, and I sort of feel that I, at every stage, was just so fortunate to kind of come under the wing of these really legendary names. You think about Judge Luttig, Justice Scalia, Ken, and then Ted, who was really the person who hired me into the Solicitor General's office. I think it's really hard to beat that list of mentors.
Well, and I did want to talk about that a little bit, and your transition to the Solicitor General's office, and just a little more about that office. I think you're the first person we've had on that's worked at the United States SG's office.
Well, it's really a special place, and I think in particular, if you want to have a career, a substantial focus of which is practicing before the Supreme Court, it's a pretty common stamp that you see on people's passports to have been in the federal SG's office, though of course state SG's offices are increasingly becoming similarly prominent. And I was really lucky to get that opportunity relatively early on in my career. And I think in part I got the opportunity because of the McConnell case, because you may remember that case involved a challenge being brought by Senator Mitch McConnell and others who were the plaintiffs that we were representing, Senator McConnell and some of the other plaintiffs in the case. But it was being brought, of course, against the government. And at the time, Ted Olson was the Solicitor General. And I think to his credit, whatever his personal views, he very vigorously defended the constitutionality of McCain-Feingold before the Supreme Court. And in some sense, I think I came to Ted's attention by virtue of my work on that case. I worked very closely with Paul Clement, who was then the principal deputy SG, and just sort of coordinating the schedule and coordinating the litigation in that case. And I think by virtue of that, I was hired the following year by Ted to go into the SG's office at a relatively early point in my career. I think I was 31 years old when I was hired by Ted to go into that office. And it was probably just as well, because as I've said in other forums, I was probably too young to be as scared as I should have been about the prospect of arguing cases before the United States Supreme Court.
Well, for those that maybe aren't as familiar, kind of explain how the SG's office works, you know, how they get their cases, and how maybe as a younger lawyer you get assigned and the types of things you do in that office.
Well, the way the SG's office gets its cases is that it has one client, but it's an exceptionally litigious one, the United States of America. And so the SG's office really handles all of the government's litigation in the Supreme Court. So if the government is arguing a case in the Supreme Court, either as a party to the case or as a friend of the court, as an amicus curiae, it's going to be a lawyer from the Solicitor General's office almost invariably who does the oral argument, who handles the briefing, and so forth. But beyond that, the Solicitor General also plays a really important role in coordinating the government's overall litigation strategy. That's a very important part of the job. It's kind of like the part of the duck that's underwater because it's by definition not as public. Mm-hmm. But the SG decides whether or not the government can take appeals to the lower appellate court. So if a lawyer in, you know, the United States Attorney's Office here in Austin wants to take an appeal to the Fifth Circuit, they have to get approval from the SG in Washington. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very significant part of the job, both for the SG himself or herself, but also for the line attorneys in the office. And one of the things I think people don't realize is it's an awfully small office. I think when we think about the government, often we think about fairly bloated components of the government. The SG's office is certainly not one of them. Mm-hmm. It's an office of around 22 lawyers. Most of those lawyers are career civil servants, mm-hmm. so they don't change from administration to administration. And when you think about the fact that they're handling essentially all of the government's litigation at the Supreme Court and supervising all of the government's litigation nationwide, that's a pretty small team of people to take on some pretty significant tasks.
Pretty much so.
Yeah, you talk about, you know, having the United States and trying to coordinate all the appellate litigation nationwide. I mean, I can only imagine the potential inconsistent positions that may come up. You're dealing with, I'm sure, you know, monitoring circuit splits, wanting to carefully select certainly the cases that wind up going up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But that's a lot of wrangling to have to do, I would imagine, for such a small office.
Yeah, you know, I certainly learned a lot about oral advocacy and brief writing when I was in the SG's office. I was, you know, lucky to work with some real legends of the Supreme Court bar when I was there, people like Michael Dreeben and Ed Lee Lawyer, and to work under great solicitors general in Ted and Paul and Greg Garr. But ultimately, I think one of the big takeaways from my time in the office was really learning how to think about appellate strategy. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why being in the SG's office is so interesting from that perspective is that, unlike in private practice, you know, there's no client that you can just pick up the phone and call. The client is the United States of America. I guess in theory you could pick up the phone and call the White House, but that's not something that SGs tend to do all that often. And even then, it's not always entirely clear, like, which component of the government is actually the client. And so you're really making those judgments yourself. And ultimately, of course, it's the SG who makes the final judgment.
Sure.
If you're a line attorney in the position of an assistant to the Solicitor General, you're really doing your best to kind of make those judgments about what's in the government's best interests, you know, which cases are the best cases to take up to the Supreme Court, you know, which cases might not be good vehicles in which to litigate issues of institutional importance. And I've taken a lot of lessons from that into my time in private practice. You know, when you're representing big companies in particular, they often are dealing with fairly similar issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of my clients are dealing with litigation nationwide, and there are strategic questions about, you know, which cases to advance in litigation, where to pursue those cases, and those judgments are not dissimilar.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about your move back into private practice. Did you go from the Solicitor General straight to Paul Weiss, or what did you do after that?
So I had one other stop on my resume. I was a partner at Williams & Connolly for a little over 10 years. I had a wonderful experience there. And, you know, in some sense, that was my first experience both as a law firm partner and as a head of an appellate litigation practice. Mm-hmm. And much as is the case now with Paul Weiss, at the time at Williams & Connolly, the firm had not really historically had a discrete Supreme Court and appellate litigation practice. And so I was charged, again, at a relatively early stage of my career with building that practice. And it was really a great experience. I probably made a lot of mistakes as I was building the practice. No one in law school gives you a manual for how to build a law practice, but I was very proud of the practice that I built at Williams & Connolly, and again, I had a wonderful experience at the firm.
You know, we have a very well-established appellate bar here in Texas, and I know there are other places that do, and appellate work is different, as you've sort of hinted at. What is the thinking behind, at least at that time, firms like Cravath and Williams & Connolly not having already dedicated those kinds of resources to that practice area?
I think one thing that's always been of interest to me as an outsider is how well established appellate practice is as a specialty in Texas. And it's kind of interesting because if you think about it in terms of Washington, you might think that if there's anywhere where there is an established appellate bar, it would be in D.C. But the reality is that specialized appellate bar is a relatively recent development. You know, when Ken joined Kirkland & Ellis in 1993, he was really one of the first to try to build that practice in private practice in Washington. And I think until quite recently, you could list a number of great litigation firms that for one reason or another hadn't done it. Now, one of the great ironies is that I had always looked at Paul Weiss from the outside and thought, here is one of the nation's leading litigation firms. Why doesn't it have that practice? And one of the things that I learned when I started talking to Paul Weiss was that it was, in fact, something that the firm had long wanted to do. But the reality is that there are a relatively small number of people who have established national reputations in appellate practice. And unless you can get one of those people, it's a very difficult thing to try to develop organically. And I think precisely the reason why I think Paul Weiss wanted me to join the firm was because by that point I had a bit of an established reputation, and I think that the firm thought this is a way of really establishing that practice.
On the topic of narrow advocacy and Supreme Court advocacy, it is different than your typical appellate advocacy. How does Supreme Court advocacy differ, and how is it that there's a different skill set to that?
Well, I think Supreme Court advocacy is different in a couple of respects. One of them is that I think there's a tremendous temptation to think that Supreme Court arguments are a lot like other appellate arguments. But the Supreme Court's not bound by precedent. It is setting the rules for the entire country. And so I think in terms of the types of arguments that you make to that court, they are typically much more arguments about first principles and much less arguments about precedent. Now, precedent's always important, and while stare decisis is not an inexorable command, it is still significant to the court. And so you want to be framing your arguments in terms of what the Supreme Court has previously said. But ultimately, you want to convince the Supreme Court that you're right as a matter of first principles, whether that's as a matter of first principles of the Constitution or as a matter of statutory interpretation. And I think that that's different from an argument in a court of appeals. The other thing that's different is that the Supreme Court is hearing only 60 cases a year. And so it has the luxury to dive much more deeply into the cases than, say, a typical court of appeals does. I have an argument tomorrow in the Second Circuit in New York. That'll be one of three cases that is argued tomorrow. The panel may very well be hearing 10 or 15 cases that week alone. The Supreme Court hears 10 cases in a good month nowadays. And so the court does have that luxury of diving more deeply, and that means that as an advocate, you really have to be prepared to get, you know, much more deeply down into the weeds than in other courts.
And then the oral advocacy part of it, too. I mean, what bigger stage is there as far as an appellate lawyer than standing at the lectern at the Supreme Court building in Washington? I mean, that has to be just an amazing experience.
Well, there's no doubt it feels like you're in the major leagues. You know, it feels like you're at Yankee Stadium, or, you know, since I'm a college basketball fan, it feels like you're in Allen Fieldhouse when you're arguing in the Supreme Court. And I think it's hard not to feel a sense of awe at the occasion. And so I think in some sense, yes, I think whenever you argue a case in the Supreme Court, there's something very special about that. And even as somebody who's done it a fair number of times, I still feel that sense of awe whenever I walk into that building. That having been said, for any self-styled Supreme Court litigator, the reality is that we all spend the majority of our time arguing cases in the courts of appeals, in the state appellate courts, and frankly, that's one of the things I really enjoy about my job, is having the opportunity to travel around the country, to argue in all of the circuits, as I've had the chance to argue in front of new judges, because one of the differences with the Supreme Court is that you know who you're getting when you have a case in the Supreme Court, whereas in the courts of appeals, you typically don't know until a few days beforehand who your judges are going to be. That's a major difference in terms of the way you approach the task of oral argument.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. So with only, 60 cases a year that get argued and relatively few in terms of what gets filed, how do you find the cases? Do the cases find you, for cases that you think you're going to take to the Supreme Court?
There's really no one formula for that, Jody. I think I've been very fortunate in that cases have largely found me, and often in very haphazard ways. When I argued the sale of law case on the constitutionality of the CFPB, really the reason that I had the opportunity to argue that case was that the lawyer who had handled the case below, a terrific lawyer from California by the name of Tony Visconti, had worked with me many, many years before on a pro bono cert petition. Mm-hmm. And when the Ninth Circuit issued its adverse decision in that case, he remembered me and called me, and we talked about the case and ended up taking it on. And I think particularly as I get older, I find it's often those sort of coincidental occurrences, a client who saw me speak at an event like this and remembered me and a few years later called me to hire me for a Supreme Court case. This happened to me a couple of years ago. There's really no one mechanism, by which the cases sort of come to folks like me. I will say that one interesting thing about my career, and I think that this is pretty typical, is that the vast majority of the cases that I handle at the Supreme Court are cases that I didn't handle in the lower courts. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, that's one significant difference from even cases at the Court of Appeals level. Some mm-hmm. significant percentage of the cases that I do at the Court of Appeals level are cases that either my firm handled at the district court level or that I may have even had some involvement with at the district court level. But at the Supreme Court, the cases that the court hears are so few, and often they're not actually the types of cases that a big firm like mine handles at mm-hmm. the Court of Appeals level. And so that's one of the reasons why I think the inflow of cases can be somewhat haphazard.
Sure.
Sounds like just how I get my case.
Do you tend to typically get involved at the cert stage, or do you get involved at all different parts of the process depending on the case?
It really depends. Last year I had three arguments at the court. One of those was a case where we did the cert petition. Two of those were cases where we represented the respondent and we didn't get called until after cert got granted. Mm-hmm. And I much prefer to be involved at an earlier stage of the case, not least because it really gives you the opportunity to frame the case, mm-hmm. particularly at the cert stage, which is very important. But it is what it is.
Sure.
And every case is different, and sometimes clients don't realize until much later in the process that it makes sense to bring in someone who's a Supreme Court specialist.
In terms of cases that you do, working at a larger law firm, do you have time for pro bono cases in the Supreme Court?
Absolutely, and it's one thing that my firm, Paul Weiss, is very committed to, and that is pro bono work at every level of the court system. Our firm has an incredible tradition of pro bono work going back to its work on Brown versus Board of Education. And so the firm is extraordinarily supportive of pro bono work at the Supreme Court. We recently handled a very important case involving the Armed Career Criminal Act, the federal statute that imposes mandatory minimum sentences on certain repeat offenders. And we prevailed on a very important interpretive question concerning that statute. Because my practice has always had a significant focus on criminal work, most mm-hmm. of the pro bono work I tend to do at the Supreme Court level is in the area of criminal law. But over the years, I've handled a variety of different types of pro bono cases at the court.
I've always heard of pro bono as kind of being one way of getting into U.S. Supreme Court practice. Just from observing others, has that been your observation as well?
I think that's often true. The reality is that the competition for Supreme Court cases is so great that, even for clients who aren't traditional pro bono clients, there are any number of lawyers who will offer to handle those cases for free. I'm often reminded of something that John Roberts, when he was not the Chief Justice of the United States, but simply a country lawyer, said, which is that, you know, if you need to have heart surgery done, you probably wouldn't go with the person who called you up and offered to do it for free. But there's a lot of that going on in the Supreme Court bar, and I think a relatively small number of us, frankly, who can charge, much less charge anything resembling our normal rates for Supreme Court work. So the reality, I think, for younger lawyers who want to break into the Supreme Court bar is you kind of have to do that in order to have those opportunities. And that just, again, is a reflection of the fact that the court is taking relatively few cases, and there are a lot of people who want to handle those cases.
And I would think a lot of times that would mean getting involved prior to the Supreme Court, you know, in the district court, court of appeals, somewhere along the line.
One thing that's really changed, Jody, is that I think when I started as a Supreme Court litigator, it was not at all uncommon for clients to bring in the Supreme Court lawyer only after cert got granted. And that does still happen, as I mentioned, but that's the exception rather than the rule. Usually a case is fully lawyered up by the time the cert petition gets filed, or certainly shortly thereafter. And I do think that there is a lot of value to that. And the reality is that with the growth of appellate law, as especially more generally, you have a lot of really great appellate lawyers who are often involved in cases at the Court of Appeals level. If it's a reasonably significant case, particularly for the business community, which are the clients that I tend to represent, chances are that the clients are sophisticated enough that they're going to have gotten a pretty good appellate lawyer involved, even at the Court of Appeals level.
When you're getting involved after cert's been granted, does that change your approach to the case other than just knowing you're kind of confined to what's been done before? Do you attack that case any differently than you would if you were building the case up yourself?
I don't think so. I think you're certainly mindful of the rules concerning waiver and forfeiture and the like. And, you know, you don't flout those rules lightly. If you come up with some brilliant new argument, you want to be sensitive to the fact that you are somewhat confined, as you say. But ultimately, I think your approach is the same in the sense that you're trying to figure out what the very best arguments are that are going to get you to five votes in the Supreme Court. And, you know, that's really ultimately the key at the Supreme Court level is to try to figure out, as a strategic matter, given what you have to work with, you know, what is the best way to achieve your client's desired result and which arguments are going to be the most appealing to enough members of the court. And that's the most important part of the process in some sense. I have sometimes said to my associates that once you figure out what the best arguments are, the briefing and the oral argument is just about execution. And there's a lot of truth to that, I think, at the Supreme Court level. Frankly, I think there's a lot of truth to that at the lower court level as well. If anything, as you both know, at the lower court level, it's all about deciding which arguments you're actually going to make and in what order you're going to make those arguments. And particularly when you have a case, as is true in the case that I'm going to be arguing tomorrow, where you have three issues, deciding which issues to raise, how to prioritize those issues is crucially important.
How do you make your case stand out to get one of the 60 slots?
Well, I think everybody knows that there are certain basic principles about Supreme Court review. The Supreme Court typically only grants review to resolve conflicts among the lower courts, whether they're conflicts among the federal courts of appeals or conflicts with state courts of last resort. And that is certainly one of the keys. But I think one underestimated aspect of Supreme Court review is that with the court hearing only 60 cases a year, you've got to convince the court that this case is worth its time. And that means really kind of coming up with the best arguments as to why the question that you're raising really matters, why it matters to, for instance, a broad sector of the economy, or why it's going to matter to criminal defendants nationwide. And I think that that's a part of cert petitions that people often don't focus on as much as they should. People always are thinking about circuit conflicts, and everybody knows that you've got to raise a circuit conflict, and so you see a lot of cert petitions that raise them even when there isn't really one there. And that is, you know, certainly significant, but really it's all about the importance of the case. It's also all about convincing the court that the lower court got it wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, one interesting statistic that I unearthed when I was preparing for my talk today is that the Supreme Court last year reversed the lower court in more than 80% of the cases it heard, mm-hmm. which to me really suggests that the merits matter when the mm-hmm. court is deciding which cases mm-hmm. to hear. Mm-hmm. And so, although I think people often have the temptation of thinking you should leave the merits arguments to the merits stage of the case, I find myself increasingly really trying to make those arguments even at the cert stage mm-hmm. to convince the Supreme Court that there's something that it needs to correct.
It's sort of conventional wisdom before the Texas Supreme Court that the court does not grant to affirm. And so it sounds like, based on your observation, that carries through even up to the U.S. Supreme Court, too.
I think that's typically true. There's some subset of cases where the court is granting review plainly because there's just an important issue that the court needs to provide the final word on. But more often than not, when the court's granting cert, it's because somebody thinks there's something that went wrong in the lower court.
Mm-hmm. You know, with the briefing and the cert petition process, what do you kind of focus on in the cert stage? Because it's certainly sort of a different view as opposed to the merits briefing.
Yeah, I think it's really all about convincing the court why a case is worth its time. And one of the things that we try to do in our cert petitions is not to make it too complicated. One thing that I often say to our associates is that if you've got to use all 9,000 words to convince the court that it should hear a case, it probably suggests you don't have a very compelling reason for the court to hear it. And so I filed cert petitions that are 12 or 15 pages long that have been granted, because sometimes making your pitch straightforward and elegant is actually the way to go.
Well, that's true also, I suppose. I mean, when you get to the merits briefing stage, you obviously want to brief the case thoroughly, but does that observation hold true sometimes too with merits briefs? Do you tend to push word count on those, or do you tend to be brief?
I think it's a lot harder at the merits stage in the Supreme Court to file a shorter brief. I was really impressed last term in a case called Badgero that a Texas lawyer, Dan Geiser, I think, filed a brief that was around 30 pages long. It was well under the word limit, and he ended up winning the case. And I think, I haven't talked to Dan about this, but I think he probably just made the judgment that as a strategic matter, it was much better just to keep his pitch at the merit stage relatively simple. And so it's something that I aspire to, but it's just so hard because almost by definition, when the court grants review in a case, it's because there are substantial arguments on both sides. It's an mm-hmm. interesting legal issue. It's an issue that a lot of people have written a lot about. And mm-hmm. so it's really tough. I mean, I aspire to file shorter merits briefs, but it's the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah, the Supreme Court practice is not something I really do, but one thing I've observed, and you sort of touched on this earlier, is, you know, when you're writing a brief in that court, you're writing much more from a blank slate as opposed to relying on precedent. And so it just seems like that would be just a tremendous challenge in terms of presenting the argument to the court when, I mean, just the mindset you have to be in when you realize, and you deal with this every day, I really don't, but you realize, well, what is precedent in this court, and how do I couch the issues? Is it in line with precedent versus some of the other first principles that you pointed out? And so that, to me, would, I think, present a unique challenge. I think I would have a hard time filling all the word count just for that limit. I'm so used to writing on a precedential basis as opposed to sort of this original thought. And so I just admire that whole approach. It's very interesting.
One of the things that I think about a lot, both at the Supreme Court level and more generally, is that whenever you write a brief, in some sense you have two audiences. The one is the judges who you are trying to persuade, and first and foremost, you always want to make the arguments as to why the judges should rule in your favor. But then the second audience is the law clerks and the judges themselves when they go back and write the opinion. And I often think about what things would somebody want to know when they're actually writing the opinion. What are the details that they need to be aware of in the drafting process? And sometimes I feel a certain degree of tension between those two things, because the stuff that you want to let the law clerks and judges know when they're writing the opinion is the stuff that you often put in the footnotes. And there's often a lot of detail that goes into that. But that's kind of in tension with presenting a very clean, straightforward pitch as to why you should win.
Mm-hmm. Kind of sounds like a silly question, but really, how important is the record? Because they're deciding a lot of these nationwide importance questions, and your record is certainly a vehicle, but how much do you play it up or not play it up?
I think people tend to understate the importance of the facts at the Supreme Court level, in part because when the Supreme Court grants review, it does grant review on a legal question presented. And so I think there's a tremendous temptation to de-emphasize the facts. But I think the facts really matter to the overall story, and particularly when you have relatively sympathetic facts. I often spend a lot of time figuring out how to kind of frame the facts in a way that presents a narrative that's consistent with the outcome that we want to achieve on the legal question. And I've certainly heard the Chief Justice and other members of the court talk about the importance of that narrative in a brief. And to me, that's sort of how you get the reader's attention, is by telling a compelling story about the case, how the case ended up in the Supreme Court, about the parties to the case. And so that's a part of the brief that we certainly spend a lot of time thinking about.
And then another area in kind of getting the court's attention where it's maybe more important than any other court is amicus support. How do you kind of intentionally use amicus or use that to your advantage to get the court's attention in ways that maybe your cert petition can't because of word limits and whatnot?
One of the things that's also changed over the course of my time practicing before the court is just the sheer volume of amicus support, and not just in the highest profile cases, but in even some of the lower profile cases as well. And I think that when you're representing a party before the Supreme Court, it's really important to manage that to the extent that you can. And sometimes you have more control over that than other times. But I think what you really want in an ideal world is for the amicus briefs not to be repetitive, but to be complementary, to make points that it might be uncomfortable for you to make as the party, to provide a broader perspective, as groups often can, about the implications of a ruling in your client's favor or a ruling against your client, and to try to coordinate that so that the amicus briefs aren't going to simply waste the court's time, to try to maximize the likelihood that those briefs are actually going to get read, and read not just by the law clerks, but also by the justices. And I frankly think that there's often too much of an emphasis on the amicus briefs. Mm-hmm. To me, in the vast majority of Supreme Court cases, a well-written brief for the party can cover 99% of what needs to be covered.
Right. And Carl, if you're listening, maybe hit pause or fast forward a little bit.
Well, Carl is one of the great amicus brief writers, precisely because I think he's very good at doing that. He's very good at providing distinct arguments for a different perspective. But, a lot of amicus briefs, particularly in the big cases, really don't add much value at all. And I think, frankly, in the bigger cases, the amicus briefs are already starting from a disadvantage, because if you have a case where there are 50 amicus briefs on each side, the likelihood of those briefs being read is pretty small to begin with.
Sure. Do you kind of coordinate that as the person who's taking the case to the Supreme Court to the extent that you can? I mean, I recognize some of it's just outside of your control.
Yes, I think it's no secret that the lawyers for the parties really do try to coordinate that. At the same time, one thing that I'm very mindful of is that an amicus brief is still a brief that's being filed on behalf of a client. And I do think it's really ultimately for that client to decide what they want to say. And so you try to be very respectful of that in the coordination process, because the best amicus briefs are briefs that authentically represent what a group thinks, that aren't just, efforts by the parties to get another 50 pages or 30 pages for their own brief. And you really want that amicus brief to kind of speak distinctively in the voice of the actual amicus.
So how do you prepare for a Supreme Court oral argument? I mean, I recognize it's a very different game than preparing, say, for a Court of Appeals argument. So how do you go about that?
I think the preparation process is actually pretty similar, Jody. I think the actual oral argument is different for a lot of the reasons that we've discussed. But, in the end, what I do is I sit in my office with the briefs. I reread the briefs a gazillion times before any oral argument, because the first goal of an advocate is to know what you've argued already to the court, right, and to really be the master of that. And then, you know, I'll read whatever is essential, and that depends on the type of case. If it's a case that is very case heavy, I'll spend a lot of time reading the prior decisions of the court that are significant. And, you know, in a really complicated Supreme Court case, that can be 40 or 50 cases that you really have to master. In a simpler case, it might just be 6 or 7, but you really want to master the key precedents. And if it's a case involving statutory interpretation, you want to master the relevant statutes, the regulations, and so forth. But then pretty quickly in the preparation process, again, whether it's the Supreme Court or a lower court, I really transition pretty quickly into trying to figure out what the hardest questions are for our side and what the best answers to those questions are. And I will often keep a running list of those questions just so that I have them in front of me as I'm preparing. Mm-hmm. And that leads naturally to the most important part of the preparation process, which is doing moot courts for oral arguments. Mm-hmm. I typically do 2 moot courts for Supreme Court arguments, and in an ideal world, I'll do 2 moot courts for Court of Appeals arguments as well. And I view that as really, you know, the central part of the preparation process, getting great, smart lawyers to come and be mock justices or judges, and to get a sense of what someone who is new to the case is going to have on their mind after reading the briefs. You know, people often talk about whether mooters should replicate particular justices. I don't try to operate on that level. I don't try to figure out who of my friends is going to do a good, you know, Justice Kagan or a good Justice Alito. Instead, what I try to do is to get people who think like appellate judges, so typically appellate lawyers, who are going to be able to replicate that reaction of what a smart person is going to think after reading the briefs. And for Court of Appeals arguments, typically what I'll do is I'll invite associates from my firm, from Paul Weiss, to come and be the mooters. And often clients will say, you know, well, these are associates, you're the, you know, the partner who's the head of the practice, they're just going to be obsequious. And then they listen to the moot for about 2 minutes and they realize that that's definitely not how it works. The moot courts are sort of the opportunity for associates to take out their aggression on me, and they're very good at doing that. And I often have moments of thinking, boy, there's no respect being paid to the boss here, but that's how it should be.
I was going to say, this is a game of stump the boss.
Well, and I think it is really a great opportunity, actually, for associates really to show their stuff. I've often had clients say after a moot court, boy, your associates are just so impressive. And again, typically I try to get people who haven't worked on the case before, and it's a great way of getting young lawyers exposure.
Well, and one thing I kind of wanted to ask you about, and you've touched on this earlier, how do you mentor in sort of a Supreme Court practice? Because there are so few opportunities for advocacy at the court and cases getting taken. So how do you pass those opportunities along to those that you're trying to bring up?
Well, I think it's very hard because there are so few opportunities to argue cases before the court. And frankly, even at the Court of Appeals level in a big appellate practice, when a client is hiring us to handle the case, typically they want to have the senior person in the practice do the actual oral argument. Unlike with trial practice, where there are lots of opportunities for lawyers to stand up in the course of a trial, there's only one opportunity to stand up in an appellate case, and that's for the, you know, often as little as 10 or 15 minutes of the oral argument. And so I think it's very important as the head of a practice to constantly be looking for argument opportunities for younger lawyers, you know, both pro bono opportunities, but also perhaps on smaller matters for our bigger paying clients. And that's something that has always been very important to me. But, you know, I think really the most important thing is just giving lawyers as much responsibility as possible as early in their careers as possible. And particularly on our Supreme Court briefs, it's not unusual for me to be the only partner on the briefs. I really think it's important for associates to take on that brief writing responsibility as early as they can possibly do it. And I think that that's really sort of how you develop a reputation as a top flight appellate lawyer, is first as somebody who writes really good briefs, and then hopefully as somebody who is really a superb oral advocate later on in your career.
Well, I don't want to let you go before we talk a little bit about your presentation, the subject of your presentation today, which is the U.S. Supreme Court update. We clearly don't have time for you to launch into your entire presentation. That would be very interesting, and Jody and I look forward to attending that here shortly. But maybe would you share a couple of your sort of hot takes from the term, things that you intend to cover during the presentation? Obviously, this is being recorded and won't be released for some time afterward. We're not giving anything away by talking about it now, but I don't think we would be doing our job if we didn't ask you to kind of highlight some of your, as I said, hot takes from this last term.
Well, I'm not sure that any of these are really going to qualify as hot takes, but it is such a fascinating time to be watching and practicing before the Supreme Court. I think we saw the Supreme Court really strike out in a pretty clear jurisprudential direction last year in a lot of really major areas of the law. Of course, first and foremost, we had the abortion decision in the Dobbs case, but this felt like an exceptionally consequential term across a variety of different subject areas. And, you know, when I think back on my time practicing before the Supreme Court, we've had a Supreme Court for a long time that has been in relative equipoise. It's been a 5-4 Supreme Court on a lot of the most significant questions of law. The identity of the so-called swing justice has changed over the years from, you know, Justice O'Connor to Justice Kennedy, and then for a brief time, seemingly the Chief Justice. But now we have a Supreme Court that is a 6-3 Supreme Court in a lot of significant areas that has not been afraid to revisit precedent in a lot of key areas. And I think that's a little bit of a change. It's more than a little bit of a change. It's a really significant change for those of us who are used to a court that swung in a so-called conservative direction in some cases and in a more liberal direction in others. And I think it's going to take some period of time for all of us to kind of adjust to that. And we have a number of new members on the court. We've had 4 members join the court now in the last 5 years. And I think, particularly given the shift in the court's jurisprudential direction, there are a lot of areas of the law that new membership of the court has not yet addressed. The court's going to tackle a lot of really significant areas of the law, issues like affirmative action, the First Amendment, and others next term. I think we'll have a better sense of just how profound this shift is by the end of next term when the court tackles some of those questions. And I think for purposes of the business community, again, the primary group that I represent, the court really has not tackled a lot of the meat and potatoes issues that affect businesses, issues like preemption and class actions, patent law, which, you know, is an area that the court had previously been very active in, but really has not been as active in over the last few years, securities law, antitrust law. And frankly, there isn't that much on the docket for next term in those areas of law either. And so I think it's going to be a little while before we really have a good read on how this newly constituted court thinks about those issues.
Well, we've reached the end of our time that we had planned to spend together today, Canon. It's our tradition, hopefully you have had some time to think about this, but it's our tradition to ask our guests for a tip or a war story before we end the recording. So do you have something that you'd like to offer our guests?
Well, I'm reminded of a story about my first oral argument, which was that I argued my first Supreme Court case in 2004 when I was in the Solicitor General's office. It was a criminal case called Mueller versus Mina, and I remember it like it was yesterday. I turned up at the court. We were the second case on the calendar, which is never ideal because it means that you have an extra hour to just sit there and think about the fact you're going to be arguing a case before the Supreme Court. And I was sitting at counsel table with Michael Dreeben, the longtime deputy SG who had responsibility for criminal matters, and I must have looked pretty green, as in literally green, not just metaphorically green, because right before the argument started, Michael leaned over to me and said, "Cannon, if you're going to throw up, just be sure to throw up on opposing counsel and not on me." And to this day, I've always thought that that's like the best piece of advice to throw up on the other guy. But thankfully, I managed to get through that argument without getting sick, and haven't felt nearly as nauseous since.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you giving us this time this morning, especially at the early hour. And I know this is going to be a great episode.
We're looking forward to sharing this with our guests.
It was great to be with you both. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.